Hello, welcome to the photo show. Yes, it's a cold and frosty Monday morning here. If you've got a camera, you should be out using it because it's absolutely stunning this morning. Real wintry wonderland out there. If you're not and you're sat inside at work and you manage to get the feed on and you can get in the chat room, then brilliant. Come and sit and have a chat. If you want to get in the chat room every week, it's irc.geekshed.net and the room is hashtag British Tech Network. Superb. Right, let's kick it off straight away with the news. Right, this is a great story. I love this. This is exactly what creative photography should be all about. Taking the obvious and thinking around it and coming out with something that's completely different. This is a guy called David Robinson. He's a pro photographer and he's come up with an idea. Yeah, everyone's taking a camera and shoving a camera on a drone and this guy isn't. This guy is putting a strobe light on a drone. So he's come up with the idea of taking a studio strobe, strapping it to a drone with a battery pack and flying it. He's got this massive octocopter that flies the strobe around. And he did it for a Red Bull thing whereby BMX biking, slope style mountain biking was what he wanted to cover. So he went out and he's got a flash trigger on his camera that then links through to the strobe so it fires when he wants. But because it's strobe, it'll go off multiple times off the battery. So he's got some great effects. There's a picture of him taking a picture with it on. There is a lot of flash on this, I've got to say. So the rider's going to have to be prepared for it. I'd be surprised if there wasn't a few mishaps with being disoriented. David, well done, mate. The results are superb. There you go. That's him taking a picture of the drone, taking a picture of the person, but he's captured it absolutely beautifully. He could get as far away or as near as he possibly wanted. It's entirely up to him, but the pictures are absolutely stunning. And then because it's a strobe, of course, it'll fire multiple times. So here's a shot at 9 frames a second, and he's now 10, 12 frames a second, and he's managed to capture the whole run of the guy with strobe shots taking off. Absolutely brilliant. Really, really good idea. The whole idea and concept of it is absolutely brilliant. And it's what creative photography should be about. Well done, David. Next one. Now, you know, I mean, occasionally I go on like eBay and I'll have a look through and see if there's any good camera deals on there. And 99.9% of the time, I find absolutely nothing that takes my interest and I just move on. But if you do the same thing with Craigslist and you're in Georgia, you may have stumbled across this. And it's not one of your cheaper entries. This is being sold by an anonymous person in Georgia. It is a free-floating motion head, fluid head, and it's got a bar on it that I guess he's created himself, which holds on it 5 cameras. On there, you will see a Nikon 800mm lens with an FS4 Nikon camera, high-speed battery pack and a digital back for it. You'll also see a 600mm, which is the one to the left of it, or to the right of it, as you look at the image, a 600mm Nikon lens with the same spec on the back, an FS4 camera, high-speed battery pack and digital back. There's a Nikon 400mm lens, which is 3 along to the left. That's got the same spec camera on it and the battery pack and all that kind of stuff. The Tokina 300mm is on there as well, that's in the middle. And there is a 150 to 500mm Tokina as well that's got an FS4 on the back of it with all the swing and ding as it got. So you've got 5 cameras there and 5 lenses on a fluid head, on a rather sturdy looking tripod that you can carry around to take, I don't know what, but it's great. It's absolutely great. How much is it going to cost you if you're on Craigslist? $26,000. Now, pre-Brexit rather, that would probably be a really good changeover. That would be well worth buying because the lenses themselves would be worth an absolute fortune, especially the 800mm one at the top. I might have done that. I might have spent that money to get that, but not now. I don't know whether it's sold or not. I don't know whether the guy got the price he was asking for, but that is one hell of a rig. Absolutely beautiful. Loads of pictures of it on the Craigslist listing, and it would be awesome to have. You've only got one camera, you could just go along all of them. You don't have to use all of the digital back stuff, do you? But it's there. Well done. did you buy a Karma drone? I really looked at these and really thought that they were worthwhile. And I like the way that the center bit came out and it was a handheld gimbal. I like the fact that it was instantly available with the Hero 5. But the problem they had was that they kept falling out of the sky. They lost power and would just fall and damage everything. GoPro have issued a returns notice on it. They're going to get it fixed and they're going to give you your money back. But what they're doing, as well as giving you money back at the moment, is they're giving you a free Hero 5 camera if you want. Now, I took the challenge from one of the listeners who sent in $25 trying to help me get one. And I bought one. And I have to say, I was extremely impressed. I really like the GoPro. It's 2 hours of battery life, and battery life has always been the big Achilles heel of GoPro. It's brilliant. I absolutely adore it. I've got another story a bit later on in the gear for you, which will make it even more valuable to you if you like your off-roady stuff or mountain biking or something like that. So there you go. You get your returns. You get to send your Karma drone in, get your money back on it, and they'll send you a free GoPro 5 as well. That is product return done properly. Well done, GoPro. Really impressed with that. Do you love the pictures that you get from space? You know, all the ones from the ISS. They are stunning, absolutely gorgeous. And I've seen a few of the videos about how they shoot them with the blacked out halo that goes around, and they kind of poke their head through. So there's just zero reflection from light sources and that kind of stuff. Really good stuff. Well, they've got a room up there where they store all the camera stuff, and it's like it's Velcroed to the wall, yeah? Well, now there is, the ISS has 360 degree cameras where they'll record a video in 360 degrees, and you can pause it or you can scan through it and do, you know, click and grab the video and move it left and right on YouTube and actually follow the person that's flying past you as you go. It's absolutely brilliant. They did it, and here you go. They went through the camera room. And if you are into your Nikon, I think there's probably nothing there that that Nikon make that they don't have. They've got tons of bodies. They've got absolutely loads and loads and loads of lenses and peripheral equipment and accessories. It is absolutely stunning. I can't get over how much they've got. It's really, really cool. And that's where all the great photos come from. Superb. And the fact you've got this facility now to sort of scroll backwards and forwards and look wherever you want in the video while it's playing is really, really awesome. They've got a flash there as well. I guess that's for the internal shots, though. I don't think that's for the stuff down onto the earth, because I don't think the flash would be much use, really. One of the people that I can't say I've got a lot of love for is Elton John. I saw him at the Birmingham Arena. I didn't think he came across as being a particularly nice bloke, but he's got a massive photo collection. He has one of the largest private photo collections in the world. And he stores it all in an apartment in Georgia. He's got 25,000 prints that he's collected over the last 25 years. They range from seminal figures such as Brassey, Imogen Cunningham, Andre Kurletz, Dorothea Lange, Tina Modotti, and Alexander Rodchenko. I only know who two of they are. He's also got stuff, portraits that were done by Man Ray as well, which is great. Things that were pictures taken of Matisse, Picasso, and Breton. There's loads and loads and loads of stuff here. There's over 70 artists and 150 rare vintage prints from the 20s moving forwards. And it's absolutely stunning, absolutely stunning. He has decided to allow it to be shown. So all of these were very carefully taken down and packed up and put into, that's one of the corridors through his apartment. They were put into a crate and shipped over, and there is a Tate Modern exhibition on at the moment. They've said that booking is essential, unquote. So there you go. It looks stunning. It absolutely looks gorgeous. I loved the pictures. They're beautifully done. And I would definitely go down if I was down in London for the day. Well done, Sir Elton. Although I'm not your biggest fan. Romanian Velex Galmeno. I've probably said that wrong. Galmenu. Bought a camera second hand on eBay. It was a Balder Baldix camera, and he bought it online from eBay, and inside when he got it there was an undeveloped roll of film. So he thought, I'll tell you what, I'm going to undo it. So he undid the film and he sent it off for processing. And it came back and there was a whole load of people at a wedding. Now, everyone presumed it was somewhere in Scotland because there was a little bit of tartan kicking around and it was quite a stony, slaty location. And because it was black and white, they couldn't tell that the colour of the stone was actually honey-coloured. And if they had, they'd have known that that was somewhere down in the Cotswolds. He went to the BBC. The BBC Scotland got involved and put it out on the air. And eventually someone turned up saying, oh, that's my sister's wedding. So the lady on the left is Kathleen. She was Kathleen Bremner. And she married a guy named Peter Maloney, who's the chap on the right. And they got married at Burley Court Hotel in Gloucester. So there you go. Person found. There's not a happy ending to the story, though, because the marriage didn't last as long as the film. It was significantly less, to be honest. And Kathleen now still lives in Gloucester, but Peter has long since moved to Australia. But well done, BBC, for helping solve the mystery. Martin in the chat room says, that's a lot more kit than I was thinking there was on the ISS. He's also the one of the people from the London Mac User Group, and they're having an end-of-year quiz on the 12th of December. That's next Monday, and it's at the James Something Pub in Marylebone. Now he's going to type the proper name in, and I'll tell you the proper name at the end of the show. But it's not far from the station. And Marylebone. It's great going, lovely group of people. If I can be there, I'm going to be there, but at the moment I've got no reason to be down at the moment. I've got some other stuff that I need to do, so we'll wait and see. But certainly I will try and get there. Right, so it's time for the gear. Christmas is coming then, so we've got a few things here that might interest you. If you know a Nikon shooter, then you will have to explain to them why you think they would like one of these. This is a Photo Diox Pro. It is an adapter, effectively, so that you can use the lenses of any Sony Alpha camera on a Nikon body. So if you swap from Sony to Nikon, you've got all your lenses from Sony and you think, oh, what can I do with these now? Shall I put them on eBay? You don't have to. This is a fully auto adapter. You're going to lose some cropping here from the lenses. So, I think you're probably going to find that I couldn't find anything what the accurate cropping was, but you're going to probably go up. So if you've got a 200mm lens, you might end up going up to around 250mm using this because it's got that slight extension effect of being on the lens. The thing that's nice is that they're fully auto. Now, Canon users have been able to use alpha lenses through this company for a long, long time. And apparently, there's a reason why that they couldn't do it. We had to create a fusion drive. That's the technology built into the adapter itself that lets the Sony camera control the Nikon lens mechanical aperture. I did smell a little bit on the bullshit meter there when I started reading that, but it does seem to be the case with a bit more digging. You can lose the... You can use your Nikon lenses on a Sony Alpha body. Price on this thing, it's $350, so it's not going to break the bank. I've got one of the Metabones, and that cost me more than that, and it doesn't do auto. So that's not a bad price at all. It only goes on the A mount, though, not on the E mount. So good stuff. I'd love an E mount one for me, so I can use the lenses on my alpha, but the Canon lenses, but you can't. So there you go. It wouldn't be a photo show without a Leica story. So here you go. Leica, I'm sure they bait me. I'm sure this is deliberate and it's all bull and they're just trying to wind me up. Leica have created a red lens. There you go. This is one of their Summicron lenses. It is the APO Summicron M50. F2 aperture lens. It comes with a matching red lens cap. It comes in two different shapes and sizes, and it's red, just in time for Christmas. It also comes with a nice cowhide grey case, which looks gorgeous, and I'm sure it's really high value. But because it's Leica, it's $8,950. What on earth are you on? I want whatever they're smoking at Leica, because there's no way on God's green earth that as a production cost that gives it any value even close to $8,950. And that's just the lens. You don't get the body with that. That's just the lens. I'd love to, for Leica to send me a camera and go, we really believe in our product. Here's one for you to try. And at the end of it, you'll go, God, that really was worth $8,950 for a lens. But they won't, because once I scratch and sniff, I'll realise that it's all bullshit. Don't buy a Leica. Next one. Do you own a GoPro 5? I do. I didn't know this existed, though. You can take all of the telemetry off your GoPro 5 dead easy. So if you buy the quick kit for desktop, that's the Mac app stuff that you can use and run on your desktop for processing the films. In your GoPro 5 data, there is a data layer which contains all the GPS information, all the telemetry of where the camera's been and what it's done, which is fantastic. But once you get it out into the quick software, it can create a layer, a physical layer that goes over the top of your movie that has dials and graphs and all that kind of stuff and readouts that shows you where you're going and what you're doing. And it's really, really well done. It's nicely laid out. It's very customizable. You can change the font sizes and the locations and all that kind of stuff so it doesn't interfere with your video. And you can also see a GPS line of tracking of where it's gone, the elevation change, the altitude that you're at, the distance in feet that you've traveled or miles that you've traveled or kilometers. And the direction you're heading, the number of G-forces that you're experiencing. There's tons of stuff in there. It's a really, really cool feature. I haven't had a go with it because I haven't experienced any G-force other than one using mine, because it only just, oh, I suppose it does on the reflying drone thing, doesn't it? So I'm going to give that a go. See what if I've got any data on there that's worth keeping. Well done, GoPro. How much is this going to cost you? Nout, because the quick software is free, and of course you've already bought the camera, so as long as you've got your GPS turned on and it's recording data, you can use this data layer. Really, really, really good. I haven't got any of my Christmas presents yet, says Martin in the chat room. The pub that you need to go to is the John Balcombe pub in Marylebone. Starts at 7 p.m. It's free to Elmug members, and you can join Elmug on the night. It's only 15 quid to join Elmug for the year, and it's really worth it. So well done, go along. Martin fell off the back of the chair when he saw the price of the lens. Yeah, no, it's pretty bad, pretty bad. And the last bit of gear that we've got is Canon. In 2017, allegedly, are going to release an 85mm lens in f1.4. Now, this is probably really more for portrait photographers. 90mm is roughly, 85 to 90mm is roughly where you stop getting any kind of barreling effect on any kind of optics. They already do a 1.2 version of this lens, which is 1650 quid. There is also a 1.8 version of this lens, which is 319 quid, which is an awful lot cheaper. They reckon that this one's going to hit somewhere in the middle. And I've had a hunt around to see who else does a Canon fit lens at 85mm at f1.4, and Sigma do one at £1,190. So that really is kind of, it's favouring the high end, and I can't see it being much cheaper than that, or I can't see it being cheaper at all. I can see it being more expensive, but hopefully not too much more expensive. And then Zeiss also do one, which is £4,000, which I won't be buying at all, so that's dead easily done. But it's coming in 2017, allegedly, and you can get it. My advice would be don't buy it. If you're really serious about it, you can get the f1.2. Difference between f1.2 and f1.4, and don't say it's 0.2, because in real terms, when you're using it in a photography sense, unless you're really ultra close-up, you're not going to get any difference at all in that. Once you get out beyond sort of 10, 12 feet, you won't spot the difference between 1.2 and 1.4. And once you get out past 10 feet, you're not going to spot the difference between 1.2 and 1.8 that much, really. The £319 lens would do you just fine. It's a bit of snobbery that's making you buy it over and above all of that. Definitely. If you've got a story that you think we'd like to cover, then the BBC story came from Batwench. She put that one in the chat room. And we've got a few others that have come out in the last couple of minutes. But not enough to make the shows, but we will cover them. We will do them next week. And thanks to Ian Lewis as well, who's still helping me. He hasn't done as much help this week with the dot, but that's because of just circumstances. But that's the way it works. I didn't do much with the first couple, so. But without Ian, I wouldn't have any chance at all. So well done, mate. Superb. Okay, it's time for your questions. First question comes from Magic Man. He says, "Hi Ewan, I don't want to appear a true numpty, but could you explain the rule of thirds to me when taking photos and why? Thanks for your answers. So far, I didn't consider the iPhone and great advice." This is the guy that asked the question about going out and flying away around America and that kind of stuff, didn't he? Thanks for all the answers that you did so far. I didn't consider the iPhone, and that's great advice on a lightweight tripod. That's the difference between a pro and amateur, I guess. Also, the importance of life. Love the photo show. Hopefully, put it all good use. Never know, you may be able to put a photo up for review one day. Long way to go, though, to match Ian Lewis. That's from Magic Man. Rule of thirds. Rule's not a good word. I don't like the word rule when it comes to creating artistic stuff. Generally, there seems to be a principle that the golden ratio works, so the Fibonacci principle of 1.613 or whatever it is. So your distance from your forehead to your nose compared to your forehead to your chin is the ratio of them is 1.613 in 99.9% of the population. Rule of thirds is an idea that if you look at the distance of your screen in both directions, if you drew a line one third in from the left and one third in from the right, one third in from the top and one third in from the bottom, you'd end up with a 9-square grid that would be the same proportions in each of those boxes as your overall frame. If it's 1080, it's 1080 in each box, a proportion, but not pixel size. And if it was 3:2, then each of those boxes would be 3:2. The idea is that if you put your point of interest on any of the crosses that occur in the corners, then you're striking with the rule of third. And look for things whereby you can have something that comes from the foreground, low right, say, to the background, high left, and it traverses through those third points and gives you some depth or essence of depth there. If you're doing a portrait of a person, one of the eyes that's in focus should be on the third point, perhaps, or the line of the eyes on the horizontal third point, or if you turn it portrait to take a proper portraiture, then the line of the eyes through the... But it's none of that means anything in terms of what a good or bad image is. A good image is an image that's in the eye of the beholder. There's certain advice on where you should crop and where you shouldn't crop people's faces and bodies, and that will make an instant difference. And also, one of the things that I look for with images is balance. So if I see a person who's taken a picture of someone else, I'll look for the amount of space there is from the last point of interest to their right and the amount of interest there is to the left. So I might want to see that the left eye would be on the third point, but the right eye is in the middle, and the balance between where that is from either side of the frame is there. Or if someone's got a picture of a tree stood up, I want to see even distances between last point of interest and next point of interest, top to bottom and left to right. So it's not a rule. It's the advice of thirds would be a good starting point. And if you mix rule of thirds with looking for balance in your image, then I think you'll do well. You know, good foreground, good middle ground, good background, always good advice. Think about where your subject is and what you're trying to show. One of the things that I always say to Jack when we go out on a shoot is, you know, here's your big questions. What am I trying to show? And then when you've taken the picture, look down and go, am I showing it? And if you're not, change. Don't take another picture in the same place. You're trying to tell a story with a picture, so make sure you think of how you get that across. You can always crop later on to get better framing and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'm not saying shoot for the darkroom, but don't see rule as being rule. Rule is a starting point for then your creativeness to come in and see it. Totally Ewan, I prefer people talk of subjects too small and too close to the centre, then don't follow the rules of thirds, says sardonically in the chat room. Yes, it's an advice of thirds. We're going to change it now. I'm going to get a t-shirt made with I follow the advice of thirds, not the rule of thirds. Question two from Martin. Hi, quick question. What are the three most important accessories and the three most overrated or unnecessary bits of kit for the photographer? Okay, let's do the good list first. Number one on the good list, decent tripod. Totally. You can spend all the money you like on a camera, but if you need a tripod and you buy a crap one, then you'll know about it. Don't scrimp on buying a tripod, because if you go down to Argos and get one that's $29.99, it will act like a $29.99 tripod. It will not have feet on it 2 weeks later. It will not work properly a couple of weeks later. There will be things starting to slip and move all over on it, and it gets loose and baggy and it won't hold your camera up. Or when you put it on, you'll get it falling forwards, and then you'll start to get lens creep if you've got a zoom lens or something like that. Buy yourself a really good quality tripod. My tripod that I use for work is carbon fiber, and it was £1,500, and I bought it 2 years ago, and it looks like the day I bought it, apart from the feet are dirty. It is unscratched, it is completely free of damage because I look after it. I carry it out to site on the bag. A lot of people take their tripod and they'll put a tripod carrying strap on it, and then that's it, it never sees a bag again. Well, your bag's got a strap on it. I keep it in the bag and I take it out when I get to site, and I put it back in the bag before I leave site. So it only ever comes out, stands up, gets carried around on my shoulder, stands up again, and then goes back in the bag before I walk off site. I spent 1,500 quid on it. I'm not going to throw it around like it's a piece of trait. Next thing is good quality lenses, but if you're going to buy good quality lenses, remember to buy good quality UV filters. Now, you'll get a lot of people who go, oh, you can't be a pro because pros don't use UV filters. Yeah, they do, because they buy decent quality ones, so go and get yourself a really good quality Hoya UV filter. Pay some money for it as well. Don't buy a cheap one that's £11 off eBay or off Amazon. Go and buy one that's going to knock you back 60, 70, 100 pounds, and then put that on your lens. I went out, and there's a lesson for you here. I went out to do a shoot at the start of the summer. I got my brand new Sony stuff to go with my brand new FS5 camera, and I bought a £2,000 24-70 Sony lens. I stuck it onto, and I bought a UV filter for it that cost me, I think, 100 quid. I stuck it on my camera, and while I was there, I noticed that there was a bit of dust on my lens, so I blew. I didn't realise I got a bit of dust that had caught, or a physical lump of rock that had caught in my beard. And when I blew it, this thing flew off and it hit the lens, and it scratched the outside lens. I hadn't even fired it up, this lens, okay? Not even turned it on with the camera. Had I not had a UV filter on there, that would have been, lens would have needed to go back for repolishing or go in the bin. Because I'd done it, I looked at it, I was like, oh my life, it's 100 quid down the drain. And I ordered another one off my phone before I left the site, and it was at my house when I got home to get it off Amazon. Okay. Yes, it was 100 quid down, but I'd rather be 100 quid down than £2,000 down. Buy decent quality media cards. So I'm a SanDisk lover. Here's one of mine. That's a SanDisk 256 that I use for my video camera. Absolutely stunning. There's another one of the 256s. There's a 32 gig that goes in my stills camera. Always buy decent quality ones, and buy ones that are high speed as well. The one thing that you don't want to do is get trapped by shooting off regularly and then have to sit and wait because the card can't keep up with the camera. Generally speaking, at the moment, cameras are faster than cards. So always buy the 90 megabits a second or greater, and spend the extra money because it's well worth it when you're out on site and you're not messing around. Also, the integrity of data is there as well. I've had a few cards fail on me over the years, and it's always been the no-name stuff. Apart from Kingston, I just don't buy Kingston SD cards anymore. They're crap. They're useless. I've had three fail on me, so stay away from them. And a set of macro tubes if you're an amateur, or a professional. Go and buy some macro tubes. They give you lots more versatility in the close-up. Certainly, if you want to shoot some detail, I get regularly asked to shoot detail on machines and things like that. Without my lens, my macro tubes, I'm utterly, utterly lost. I've got a text there because I'm waiting for... okay, so my wife needs some help with something, so I will do it. At the end of it, sorry. Right, don't buys, here we go. Don't buy anything that looks like a utility belt that lets you store your lenses on it or lets you buy anything. It's classics. You'll buy one of these things. The other one as well is sandbags. You'll buy yourself a really heavy sandbag and you'll take it out with you to do some shooting, and you'll find actually you should have just rested it on your bag or rested it on your rolled up coat or something like that. Don't buy those. They're a waste of money. They will be in a cupboard and you will end up putting them on eBay and no one will buy them because they all realise that they made the mistake, because everyone buys them if they're an amateur. Don't use the auto setting on your camera, ever. it's a complete waste. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, but I'd love to shoot in manual, but, oh, I can't. I can't. Manual, I probably shoot 70% of the images that I shoot, I'll shoot in manual, maybe more on some occasions. Particularly if it's daylight, I'll make sure that I'm controlling what goes on. I don't want the camera to decide what it should be. Always as well, turn off in-camera sharpening, turn off any of the compensation values that are in there. Shoot what you know you're going to get. Make sure that you take a picture with your camera when you get it, jump, look at your scene, shoot the picture, and then look at the back of the screen and say, right, okay, is that underexposed or overexposed compared to what I'm seeing, and change it. And then you'll hit a point where you realize that what you're seeing is what it's capturing, and you've got the brightness set right, and then that's it. You can calibrate them, I'm sure, if you really want to, but there's a pseudo calibration that can take place. And then trust yourself and roll up, say, right, okay, if I want to shoot an aperture priority, I'll be an aperture priority, I'll set it to f2.8, f8, whatever it is, and then trust yourself to roll around with it. Take a few more pictures, it doesn't matter. But don't do auto ever. And the last one, and this is an absolute, never, ever, ever buy anything for your tripod that says it's a ball head. Anything that relies on friction, because as with all things that rely on friction, eventually they start to wear out and they are no use whatsoever. Okay, so you're saying, okay, well, that's fine, but supposing I've had like 5 years use out of this, you won't get 5 years head out of a ball head mount for a tripod. You will get a year. You will get 6 months, and then it will start to flop around all over the place. They are not worth the money. Buy something that grips properly, not a ball head. There you go. Last question then is from Ian. How do I sharpen correctly for print, and should it look over-sharpened on the screen? Well, the answer to should it look over-sharpened, as always, is no, never, never, never. Sharpening is something that you do for output, so you would decide, okay, I'm going to put this on a web page. Well, you're fighting for very bright coloured images that are very, very keenly sharpened so that they look really, really good, and they're shrunk down as well generally on the web. So always go for a little bit more sharpening if you're doing an image for online, and always give it a saturation boost, because it'll just punch out more. You can't tell whether the person's monitor's calibrated or not, and generally they'll underexpose it a little bit. So a little bit more punch doesn't hurt. But post camera sharpening, don't ever do in-camera sharpening, should be done by the person who's printing it out. So, but it's a lost art, they never do. Printers are all wankers now. You should send the finished image to them. They should be able to scan it and apply sharpening that will match their machine and the way that their machine lays down the inks. If you are going to go to print, and you do use the word print here, Ian, then have a chat with whoever it is and ask them what DPI they print out, and that'll make a difference. Generally speaking, though, if you're doing sharpening in Photoshop or in any other image package, you've got three basic things. You've got the radius that you're going to sharpen, you've got the threshold, which is the amount of the effect that you're going to apply, and then you've got the detail. So radius is the size of the edges of the thing that you've got. So here we go, I've taken a picture here. This is a nice lady named Holly. That is an unsharpened image, so that's come straight out of the camera as a raw image that I've then put into Photoshop, and then I've just dumped it straight out as a JPEG. So let's say I wanted to sharpen this. I would go and look at the width of the hairs that we're talking about here, or the width of the eyelashes, and I would zoom right in and see what they were. So here's a picture that I've zoomed into one of her eyes, and I've then rolled in and I physically counted the pixels. That gives me my radius. So one of these eyelashes on the image when it's this size is 6 pixels. So I would set my radius on my sharpening, on my unsharp mask, to 6 pixels, because that's the detail I want to enhance. Next thing is the threshold. That's the minimum brightness change that you get. So what sharpening is trying to do is increase contrast between light and dark areas in edges. So it's trying to find and pull together edges so that they don't look soft, they look like a line. And that threshold will apply the amount of change that there's going to be on it. And detail is just what it says. It's the strength of the sharpening that will take place when you do it. So, just as an example, here's a close picture. I set my radius to 6 pixels and then I applied it. And there is the picture afterwards. Okay, so you need to download the video because I can't really explain this, but I'm just going to wobble backwards and forwards between each one. Now you're saying, okay, well, the image actually moves. No, it doesn't. That is exactly the same image duplicated and then sharpening applied or not applied. And you can see that actually it just makes that, it really does make it punch. So that instead of being soft, the detail comes to life. Okay, now that was when I'd got eyebrows that were, or eyelashes that were 6 pixels across. So if I then go back to the image that I did when I pulled it out and it was wider, you can look here. Now I went in and cancelled. This was a 3 pixel detail. So when I apply a 3 pixel detail to the same thing, it's a lot more subtle, but you can definitely still see a difference. And the 3 pixel is a much more natural looking than the 6 pixel. The more you zoom in and the harder you sharpen, the harder it's going to look. If you go too far and you get your radius too big, then you'll end up with artifacts popping up everywhere. You'll have lines that aren't there on the original image and it'll look blotchy and swirly and it'll look awful. But the thing to always start with is your radius of detail. Zoom into the image, look at the detail that you want to actually do and physically count the pixels across. And say, right, it's a 3 pixel detail, it's a 5 pixel detail, it's a 10 pixel detail. And you'll sharpen harder each time. There isn't a rule as to how much you need to sharpen, okay? But generally speaking, for the smaller output, the harder the sharpen. For the larger output, the less the sharpen, if at all. So if you look at some of the boards that I manufacture that go in people's reception areas with their products or their activities on it, most of those aren't sharpened at all. They're just as they come out of the camera because they're so big, they just don't need it. And most people will view it from probably 10 feet away or more. So the detail will be lost on them if you did that anyway. Whereas with a with something in the, something you've got that's on the web, people are going to be right up to it. They're going to be looking at it on their phone, that kind of stuff. But sharpening, should you look at it and see it as over sharpened on the screen? No, you shouldn't. It should look right to you. And that one there, between the first and the second, is correctly sharpened image. If anyone's out there and they're going, oh, I don't know whether I've sharpened enough, just send me 2 images. Send me the original one and send me the sharpened image, and I'll tell you whether you've over-sharpened it or not. Just zip them together and shove them into the email, britishtechnetwork@gmail.com, and I'll gladly give you some feedback on what you've done with it. Yeah. Some comments in the chat room, more specifically the tripod head, invest in a monopod for action or wildlife or sports, says sardonically. Yeah, I carry a video monopod around with me regularly in the back of the car and I'll pull it out and just shoot with that on. It saves a lot of stabilising later on. Sardonically says also, filter systems with a big stopper graduate to try to balance your washed out UK skies with the foreground. Yeah. I'm not a great lover of graduated filters. I find some use for them in the past and then not others. I'm not overly impressed by them. So that's a use case for me. There we go. And turn off lens stabilisation, at least on Canon cameras. It doesn't do you any favours optically. Turn it off if you're shooting video for sure, because there's nothing worse than seeing your image go around like that trying to look for a stable point and it's not required. There you go. If you've got a question, send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and I will get it answered. No worries at all. Also, please send us a review in iTunes. The more reviews we can get, the higher we go up in iTunes and the more likely we are to appear in the iTunes charts, which means we get more listeners and we get more questions and that kind of stuff. So get your questions in, get your reviews in. We'll read them all out as well. There will be a photo show next week. We'll be back as normal. I think that's probably going to be the last show before the break up for Christmas. So we'll have a great fun day. We'll do photo show at 2 maybe, and then we'll do Mac at 4, and then we'll do big at 8. That'd be really cool on Friday. See you next week. Thanks for listening.